Let me welcome all of you, and let's pick up where we left off. Hope Rosh Hashanah was good for everyone. I just want to say a couple things before we begin. First, last class, I mentioned how the yeshiva in Brisk, was it Torah's class at yeshiva was founded by Reb Chaim Brisker, and I thought that I found something which was significant. But thanks to Moshe from Lakewood, he sent me numerous examples of pages. I'm looking at one right now where we see that the same exact information appears. And I accept what Moshe says, that although the yeshiva was founded by Reb Chaim and was under the broad influence, that doesn't mean that they controlled every little thing, because we do know that when the Soloveitchiks were in charge, absolutely, there wasn't Musar, and yet Toras Chesed did have Musar. The next thing I want to respond to, really the last thing, is to Bezalel, who challenged something I said about the Kuzari principle. So, let me talk about that for a minute. First of all, it's a little hard to explain what I mean by the Kuzari principle, because the Kuzari never actually says what is termed the Kuzari principle. So what the Kuzari principle means is not necessarily apparent. But let me read what Bezalel writes. He says that shut this off. He says that I had sort of portrayed it as, if lots of people claim to have seen something, that that creates a presumption that it happened under the Kuzari principle. And I challenge that with, let's say, the miracles dealing with Jesus. And he says the fact that an event was witnessed by a large number of people is irrelevant if that group is not identifiable. If you say that 1,000 Americans saw a miracle today, it carries no weight if the person I'm trying to convince can't confirm it with them. And he says, therefore, the thousands or hundreds of thousands of people who supposedly witnessed miracles by Jesus doesn't fit the principle's requirement. So I'm going to get back to what he says in a minute. He also adds that the revelation at Sinai narrative identifies its participants as the entirety of the Jewish people. So if someone tried to sell the story to a subsequent generation of Israelites, the absence of the story from their national tradition would have been glaring, and the people wouldn't have accepted it. And then he says that I referenced that Rabbi David Gottlieb reworked the argument into the claim that large, significant events in the histories of nations are never falsified. It's a fact of history. That's his claim. Well, I'm just going to leave that aside, because that's completely false, that large, significant events in the history of nations are never falsified. In fact, find me a nation in which large, significant events are not falsified. In fact, that's pretty standard, that in the pre-modern period, every group, every nation, every culture has all sorts of myths about their past. So let's leave that aside, though, for a minute. I just want to pick up what he says. First of all, in terms of the Kuzari proof, like I said, it's not actually in the Kuzari, but let me read you what the Kuzari says. The closest the Kuzari gets to it. In Book 1, Section 25, he mentions that the people of Israel knew their history through personal experience and through uninterrupted tradition, which is uninterrupted tradition is equal to personal experience. So, for instance, being in Egypt. So I guess you can extrapolate the Kuzari principle from there. Also, in section 61 and six in 61, the Kuzari, the rabbi is asked, because he insisted that the world is short, of what, 5,000 years old or so. He's asked, would it weaken your belief if you were told that the Indians have antiquities and buildings which they consider to be millions of years old? That is the Jewish tradition. And he said, it would weaken my belief if they had a fixed form of religion or a book concerning which a multitude of people held the same opinion. So he says that if another culture actually has a written text which is accepted and has a tradition to it, testifying to millions of years, that would create a problem. He acknowledges that. Okay. It's actually Rav Sadia Gaon in the Emunot V'Dayot, who himself really comes closest to the so-called Kuzari principle. He says in the first book, section six, he speaks of the marvelous signs and proofs witnessed by the Jewish people, such as the 10 plagues, the Red Sea, etc. And then he says, it's hard for me to conceive of a scheme whereby a people numbering something like 2 million souls could be nourished for 40 years, etc. So he says that's a miracle. And he says, in the next paragraph, it's not likely that the forebears, the children of Israel, should have been in agreement on this matter if he considered it a lie. If they told their children, we lived in the wilderness for 40 years eating nothing but manna, and there's no basis for that, their children would have said, you're telling me a lie. It's not true. So that's, and then he says the children would not have accepted such a statement unless there was a tradition, or no, unless there was general agreement. He doesn't say a tradition. He says that he doesn't really say that though. He doesn't say either. He says that he says it's likely that they wouldn't have been in agreement on this matter if they considered it a lie. So it's not so much tradition, but uniformity, I should say. Not that you receive something from tradition, but that's uniform. I guess that is the Kuzari proof. Okay, so here's the problem. And this is Bezalel what I mean to say. First of all, I don't know if your criticism is so apt for a couple of reasons. First of all, it is true that in the past, people did regard, if lots of people claimed to have viewed something, it did require a presumption of correctness. That's the only way to explain, for instance, how Jews acknowledged the miracles of medieval Christian saints. At least that's the only way I can explain it. But more than that, and I can give it you the references if you're interested in that, there's a few problems. First of all, I'm going to show you a pasuk here. Let's see. I got to pull it up here because it disappeared. The pasuk I want to show you. If you look in 2 Kings, chapter 23, verse 21, it tells us that this is the chapter dealing with the finding of the Sefer Torah. The king commanded all the people, saying, keep the Passover unto the Lord your God, as it's written in the book of the covenant. For there was not kept such a Passover from the days of the judges that judged Israel, nor in all the days of the kings of Israel, nor the kings of Judah. So here we have Edut Nehmanah from Tanakh that tells us that the people didn't keep it. They didn't know about Pesach. They knew nothing about this. And by the way, this applies not just, you had righteous kings before this. This is Josiah, but you had before that Asa, you had Jehoshaphat, Joash, not just the wicked kings. They didn't know it. So what does this mean? Presumably this the Torah was maybe the private reserve of the Kohanim, or who knows what it was. Point being that they were then told about it and they didn't challenge it. They were told that we were in Egypt, we'd be, as a reward for that, as a remembrance of that, we fulfill these mitzvot. They didn't challenge anything, they accepted it. But we see in Tanakh that there's a break in the tradition, and the people didn't know about it. That's just from Tanakh. Furthermore, what do you say about something like this? The book of Matthew, chapter 27. This is written 30, 40 years, 50 years after the event, when it talks about after Jesus dies, verse 51, the curtain of the temple was torn, the earth shook, rocks split, tombs broke open, the body of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tomb, went into Jerusalem, and appeared to many people. So what's going on with that? This is talking about something that how come people didn't say, well, it never happened? I'm living in Jerusalem. I never heard of this. My father's in Jerusalem. The point being is that we have numerous examples throughout history of people, even identifiable people. In this book by Yehuda Gelman, this was from God. He has a whole chapter dealing with this, and he speaks about the Lotus Sutra and by in Mahayana Buddhism that talks about, this is page 79, for 2,000 years they have believed the story that the Buddha and his 80,000 enlightened ones, and each are given a name, and the hundreds and all the miracles that he did, and it's the exact parallel to the Sinai story. And of course, I don't think any of us are going to accept this. I could go on and on. The point which I'm trying to make is this idea that because you have a tradition, they have a tradition. They have an exact same tradition, and they believed it for thousands of years. And they make claims to miraculous cosmic events. How could they have come to believe it? They came to believe it simply that someone came up with a story. He starts spreading it. You can imagine this. The reason you can imagine this is because it happens in every society that someone comes up with a story and says that our forefathers, wherever they were, there was a great prophet, and he told them. And no one ever challenges this, or maybe a few people did, but these stories get a life of their own and enlarge. And you can find this in every single culture and human civilization, stories that are invented that way. So the Khuzari proof, I don't find it very impressive, and I'm happy to say that as far that really the Khuzari himself doesn't say it. I hope that satisfies you. If it doesn't, what can I say? And as I said, even in our own tradition, Tanakh acknowledges that there was a break, and that the people had to believe the prophets and the Kohanim because they didn't have a tradition anymore. That's the whole point. And they had to accept when they were told you have to celebrate Pesach, let's say. They had to accept the fact that this was correct because the Torah, the Tanakh testifies that they didn't have the Torah. They were living basically ignorant lives, but they accepted it and they believed it because they trusted the person telling it to them. And that's what we're supposed to trust, but it's not a proof. Okay, let us move on. The last class, I didn't get a chance to finish it, so I want to begin with telling you something about this individual who was the leader of the anti-Mussar forces, together with Rav Burstein of Tavrig, Rav Itzhak Ponovitch. I told you that in the early part of the 20th century, the two greatest Mechadshim, Torah scholars, were regarded as him and Reb Chaim. And I gave you a testimony from someone that in their lifetimes, Rav Itzhak Ponovitch was actually regarded as a greater Mechadish. Before I tell you some stories, though, I mentioned something about Marxism. So let me share this with you because it's quite interesting. Hold on, let me get it out here. We know that Rav Itzhak was influenced, if I can find my page, well, here it is, was influenced by leftist views, let's put it this way. And how do we know this? After the February 1917 revolution, which brought Kerensky to power, there was a group formed among the Orthodox, and Rav Itzhak was one of the leaders, called Mesoras V'Chairos, that tradition and freedom. And over 50 rabbis in 1917 came to Moscow for discussions about, how to deal with the new reality. The Tsar was overthrown. The Kovno Rav was there. Rav Burstein was there. Rav Itzhak was there. Now, one of the issues that was going to be discussed was redistribution of property. As I'm sure you know, the elites in Russia, they controlled all the property, and people lived on it. I mean, even after the serfs were freed, basically they worked other people's land. So the idea of national of the redistribution of property to make it fair, because the thinking was that these wealthy oligarchs controlled all the resources. So the question that the rabbis had to deal with is this halakhically permissible? Can you advocate for this? Because after all, these wealthy robber baron types, it's their property. And how can the government just remove the property? How can you? Rabbi Yehuda Graubart, who would then go to Toronto, and he was one of the big rabboni. He's the one that established the Eruv in Toronto, the third Eruv in North America after St. Louis was the first, followed by New York. He wrote the response of Chavali Ben Imi, but he also wrote a book called Sefer Zikaron, which is basically a book of a memoir of the time. And he tells us that the rabbis were, it was very controversial about among the rabbis, and many opposed the step. And Rav Itzel Agata, as recorded by Rav Yehuda Graubart, and he said the following. He said as follows, that the political program, namely the redistribution of the land, is necessary because that's how we're going to be able to bring the young people and the street to our organization. And he said, and we see Kol Yisrael, Chafetz, but the Jewish people supports this. They support the redistribution of it. And therefore he says, since we see that Kol Yisrael supports this, Bevadai Me'es Hashem Ha'Sazos, that this is obviously God's intent. And listen to this. Uklal Yisrael Hu Gavoa V'Na'aleh Migdolei HaTorah. And Kol Yisrael, that is the masses, the pious Jewish masses, are above, are more significant or raised above, higher up than the Gedolei HaTorah. Yisrael Inenu Nevim B'nei Nevim. So first of all, this is a shocking statement because among the Rabbani, usually it's just the opposite. The Gedolim are the highest and the masses are below. But here Rav Itzel says that no, the masses are above the rabbis. And we know that already from the Gemara, because if the rabbis make a decree, but the masses, the pious Jewish masses, don't accept it, then the decree is not, it's not binding. It's what they call Gezeirah Shein Rov Lezibur. But still, this is an exact opposite to the typical Haredi position. The Haredim have this expression that Das Balabatim is the opposite of Das Torah. So what Rav Itzel says, if the Jewish people think that the concentration of land in the hands of this tiny minority is unjust and should be redistributed, even if the rabbis claim that redistribution of the land is robbery, the opinion of the Jewish people overrides the opinion of the rabbis in this matter. Now, that's how it's portrayed in Rabbi Graubart's work. We have another discussion dealing with the same period in a book by Yaakov Mark. He wrote it in Yiddish first, Gedolim and Unzer Zeit, and then in Hebrew, Gedolim in our time. And he also discusses, first of all, he says that Rav Itzel was greatly respected by the radicals, the Jewish radicals, which included, he says, at least one of his own sons who was arrested in 1905 for revolutionary activities. He was also very interested in socialism, Yaakov Mark tells us, and he knew Rav Itzel. And he tells us that he carefully went through Karl Marx's Das Kapital. And he was greatly impressed by Marx's ideas, as were many. But Mark notes that Rav Itzel said about Marx that he can't agree with his positions because they oppose Torah law that protects private property. So here we have a contradiction because he's quoting Rav Itzel is saying that he likes Marx, but he can't agree with this idea that you can just confiscate property. All I can say is that presumably he said what Mark records, but when it came time to this event after the revolution of 1917, he adopted a different position. Now, as to how, from a halachic standpoint, he could have supported redistribution of wealth if the Torah protects private property, I don't think this is a difficult problem because, as far as the rabbis are concerned, government has the right to engage in all sorts of taxation and redistribution of wealth, as long as it's not considered confiscatory. So if the robber baron, if the barons still have a significant amount of money, if you take some of their property, which you assume was taken by them in an unfair fashion anyway, from the people, that would be okay. I mean, there's Dina the Mahusa Dina, and then there's, thievery, but we're assuming it's not thievery. Now, Rav Henkin, for instance, by the way, what is taxation? Taxation is a form of confiscation of property. I mean, fine, so you can say you're going to tax me for the money I make, but then you're going to tax me when I die? Estate tax? That's double taxation. And what gives you the right? I mean, you could say, what gives you the right to that? Well, governments have the right to take money and redistribute it. That's Rav Henkin even has a whole piece. Sometimes these rabbis, you can admire their Torah knowledge, their knowledge of economics is often lacking. But so I put Rav Henkin in that category because the whole thing about the value of rent control. And how great rent control is. And I think every economist, I believe, from the left to the right, will acknowledge that rent control creates more problems than it's able to solve. But that's, well, how is rent control? It's my property. I should be able to rent at whatever price I want to. The answer is no. Government has the right. Now, Mark also says something interesting. He says, he says, he didn't get Yiddish anachas from his children. And that's another way, a polite way of saying that his children did not remain Orthodox, or at least his sons, which is, I guess it's his sons, maybe put it, which is obviously a common phenomenon in those days. Now, if you look at the Wikipedia page here, it actually tells us about the sons of Rav Itzchak. And it tells us that, that most of his children and descendants were killed in the Holocaust. One daughter moved to Moscow, where she survived, and it mentions who their children were. And a descendant actually learned in Or Sameach, I guess, at Baal Tshuva, and he became close to Ramosha Soloveitchik. And when the Communist Empire fell, he helped establish the yeshiva Toras Chaim, which I believe still exists in Russia today, in Moscow. Then he says he had another daughter, Duba. She taught Hebrew. She married this man, Dov Levin, who was a Zionist activist. They had three children, and you can read about it there. The children, they sent their children to Mefitzi Haskola school in Riga, and the family came to Israel, where the descendants live today, completely irreligious. But what Wikipedia doesn't know and doesn't mention is that he had another daughter who married this individual, Rav Avraham Yaakov Brill, who was a rabbi of Anshei Lubavitch in Brownsville. That's where my grandmother was from. Unfortunately, she's not alive to ask me to ask her if she knew him. He died in 1943. And here's pictures of him. He a real Rav. And I don't know why it's not mentioned. If you look, by the way, on the here's the title page of his volume of Tshuvos, Shaylos and Tshuvos. It mentions that he comes from, his father was in Ponevezh. He was born in Vilkomir. And it says his books. He was the rabbi of Rabbi Yaakov Meskin. I'm talking about this Rabbi Meskin, rabbi in Beis Medrash HaGadol Nusach Sfard. Says where he was earlier,
I
including he
wonder
was
whether
rabbi in
he's related
Ponevezh.
to Rabbi Muskin of Los Angeles.
No relation. The different, maybe in Europe it's related, but Rabbi Muskin's father, Rabbi Muskin's father, his grandfather was a rabbi in Chicago, in here, Burlington, Vermont, in America. So why do I mention it? Because I would just want to add two stories that he tells us about Rav Itzchak. By the way, there's another work. If you look, you can find Nishmas Chaim by Rabbi Chaim Dov Ber Gulevsky. I showed you before the picture of me with Rabbi. Actually, hold on. Let me take it out here. I want to show you the. I don't know what happened. It was on my screen and then it disappeared. But I will. I'll show you a picture of this Rabbi Gulevsky. I've showed it before, but we have new people here. So this is Rabbi. He taught at, if any of you old timers from YU might remember him, he taught at the TI, at Teachers Institute at YU. This is Rav Chaim Dov Ber Gulevsky, the grandson of the Dayan of Bris, Rav Simcha Zelig. So he has a number of works on halacha, but also he lots of historical stuff. Now I can't say if any if the historical stuff is true, but at least he's reporting what he heard growing up, and he's full of interesting stuff. He says that this is in his book Nishmas Chayim, page 13. He says Reb Yitzchak had a son who was very talented, but he went off to Tarbo Sarah. He became irreligious, and it says that Reb Yitzchak tried to convince him, to be on the Torah path. And one day, the son started talking about how the little peasants that we live with are on a higher level than the Avos HaKadoshim. And after that, Reb Yitzchak knew there's no more to talk to him about. But here's two stories from Rabbi Meskin. One is, it's in Yonah DeYoma. He testifies himself. This is in his comment, Rabbi Meskin's commentary on Rosh Hashanah, page 21. He says, I saw Admor. This is how he refers to Reb Yitzchak, as the Admor. Usually they only refer to Hasidic Rebbes like that, but no, he refers to him as Admor Maran, Reb Yitzchak Rabinovich. He said, I saw him when he would call out the Tekiyas before the Baal Tokeya, and he would cry like a baby. That's the exact same thing we know that Reb Soloveitchik records that Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, when he saw someone, the Chabad guy who was going to blow a shofar, crying, and he said, why are you crying? Do you cry, any other mitzvah you do, not recognizing the gravity of the moment? This is just another mitzvah, like taking a lulav. Do you cry before you take a lulav? But here we see there Reb Yitzchak would cry when he was the makri for the tkiyas shofar. And then Rabbi Meskin says something which I think a lot of the people won't be too happy with, but he says it. He says Reb Yitzchak all year was learning Torah. He was a Mayan Miskaber. He was being Mechadesh Chidushim Niflaim. All of his thoughts, day and night, were on holy matters. And every matter for him, every day for him, he says, was like Rosh Hashanah. And he says, so what is he doing? If every day is like Rosh Hashanah, what's he crying for? And then he says, Tekiyas HaShofar, for him, people of his level, that's like any other mitzvah. Maybe like the Rav said, and it doesn't bring it. You think it doesn't bring about hisorerus, excitement. But he says that. Listen to this: the hisorerus of tkiyas haShofar kedei lavo lidei tshuva. The idea that you hear a shofar. In other words, he says for the gedolim, shofar is a mitzvah like any other mitzvah. But the idea that shofar is supposed to bring us to tshuva. If I said it, you throw stones through the screen at me. But this is Rabbi Meskin. He doesn't have a source. This is his own idea. He says, listen to this. He says, for the masses, the Stam, the Hamonam, the people who spend their lives in meaningless pursuits, Hevle Yisman, I shouldn't say meaningless, working for a living, all the other things of life. For them, when they hear kol shofar, baim ledei tshuva, that brings them to tshuva. But the tzaddikim, they don't need it. For them, it's just another mitzvah, which is what basically, I guess, what the Rav quotes Reb Moshe Soloveitchik is saying. So then why was he crying? He says, because the anava shalahem hemachzikim atzman, they, because of their great anava, they treat themselves as if they're, like the average person, and therefore they cry because of the fear of Shamayim. But really, he says that the righteous people, this is something, the high people, this is something they choose, sort of like they put themselves in that mindset. But really, fundamentally, this wouldn't apply to them. It would just be another mitzvah. But he did cry. Okay, so I guess it still takes away the Rav's point. And he finally, Rabbi Meskin, in his introduction to his book Makel Yaakov, he says something else about Reb Ponovej. There was another rabbinic conference in St. Petersburg, which Reb Chaim Brisker was there, and the Or Sameach. And he says that when Reb Yitzchak went away, Rabbi Meskin, who was a rabbi in Ponovej, not the rabbi, but a rabbi, he was asked to come to go to Rav Itzla's house where everyone would come for Dine Torah and things, and he filled in for him for a number of weeks, I think 5 weeks. And there was questions about Pesach. It was before Pesach and Gittin, etc. And he says that at the end of this conference, the 5 weeks, He says, Baha Admar mi Peterburg le Ponovish. In other words, the Ravitzela comes to Ponovish. He comes into the house and he found us, as me and the other rabbis who were filling in, sitting there. He doesn't say a word to us. He simply says to his Rebbetzin when he comes in, I need to eat. Give me some food. And he ate and he benched. And afterwards, he came in and he told us why he acted this way. You know, like what? As soon as he comes in, that's what he cares about. Food. He says that I don't need chadash. And in St. Petersburg, there was no yashan. Therefore, there was nothing, hardly anything for me to eat of substance there. So after 5 weeks, he's starving. So Rabbi Meskin says, v'sha'alti l'admor. I asked the Rebbe, you know, Rabbi Vitzela. So what did Reb Chaim Brisker and Reb Meir Simcha do when they were in St. Petersburg? And Reb Vitzela says that Reb Chaim, there's Balabatim in St. Petersburg who took care of him and got him Yashan food. He goes, I don't have Balabatim like that. He had Balabatim who knew him. And Reb Meir Simcha of Divinsk, he ate the Chadash. He didn't eat Yashan. And he says that when he became rabbi, I guess this might have been a thing when they became rabbis. He says when he became rabbi in his town, the deal was that he would only observe Isra Chadash in Dvinsk, but not when he went to other places. But me, Reb Itzela, when I became Rav, I made an agreement that I wouldn't eat Chadash, and I didn't have any Tanai, any conditions. So I had nothing to eat for 5 weeks. This is the only place I know of where I've seen such a thing, and I've seen rabbinic contracts where the rabbi, either in an official or sort of unofficial way, takes upon himself as an act of piety when he's hired not to eat chadash. I don't know of any other examples where you see that this was an act of piety, not just an act of piety. We know it was an act of piety, but something what they actually took like as a like an oath, a neder of sorts, that they're not going, now that I'm appointed Rav, I got to be on a high level, I'm only going to eat Yashan. Now, mind you, every one of these rabbis, not one of these Gedolim, Reb Chaim Brisker, or Witzel, or Meir Simcha, none of them ate what we call today glatt kosher. They all ate regular kosher, but that's a topic for a different time. So that was not even a havamin, as we say in Lita, that you're going to adopt such a thing in okay, let's return to our discussion. The last thing, if you recall, was we dealt with Rav Kahaneman. And by the way, when the Ponovez Yeshiva was founded in 1919, what did Rav Kahaneman do? He appointed a Musar Mashgiach. You can see pictures, there's videos online of the Ponovez Yeshiva from the 1930s. Someone went in Eastern Europe, and he went to Ponovezh, and he took videos. You can find it, I'm sure, on YouTube. But the great opponent of Musar in his youth, when he established his own yeshiva, he appoints a Musar Mashgiach. Rav Kahaneman, there's something of note as well. If you look, the Chazon Ish has a letter to Rav Chaim, sorry, Rav Chaim Moshe Grozinski has a letter to the Chazon Ish, in which he talks about a candidate for the chief rabbinate of Eretz Yisrael after Rav Kook dies in 1935. He talks about how this person, how great he is, etc. Because the letters of the Chazon Ish, they always take out the names, you have to speculate. Rav Soloveitchik told his students that the Chazon Ish was referring to him. The election was, Rav Herzog. It was between Rav Herzog and Rav Charlap, Yaakov Moshe Charlap. And Rav Herzog was, I'm talking about Tel Aviv. Sorry, for the Tel Aviv rabbinate, not for the chief rabbinate. Chaim Moser has another letter in 1935. So who are the three candidates? It was Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Herzog, and, Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel. Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, probably the Lindenbaum family, at least a part of it, is our descendants from Rav Amiel of Antwerp, a bleeding Mizrahi figure. He was the eldest of the group. In fact, in a previous class, I cited this from this new article by Aviad HaKoli, like a, I don't know, 50-page article on Rav Soloveitchik's candidacy for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv. And in the article, we see that Mayor Bar-Ilan, you know, speaking for Rav Soloveitchik, you know, their family. And I said, this shows that what Rabbi Ganach says in the name of his uncle, that Mayor Bar-Ilan opposed the Rav's candidacy, isn't correct. Well, I'm going to have to apologize to Rabbi Ganach, because despite what Mayor Bar-Ilan was doing publicly, speaking and, you know, putting forth a good word for Rabbi Soloveitchik, his relative, the fact is that I have absolute proof, a letter from Mayor Bar-Ilan to Rav Amia, which I recently discovered, showing that Bar-Ilan did support Rav Amia. And I know the Soloveitchik family would be very upset to hear this, but Rav Ganach reporting in name of his uncle, who was involved in this issue of the election, is absolutely correct. So you have this letter of Rav Chaim Ozer to the Chazon Ish. Is it to the Chazon Ish? I think it's to the Chazon Ish. Yeah, to the Chazon Ish, that he says that one of the candidates is Hamuvchar from all the candidates. But, you know, it all depends on the people who are in charge, and they're going to give preference to a Mizrahi Boet, the leading Mizrahi figure. So you knew that he wasn't referring to Rav Amiel, even Rav Amiel, because Rav Amiel was a leading Mizrahi figure. So, and Rav Herzog was also Mizrahi. So Rav Soloveitchik at this time was not a Mizrahiite. So he told his students that it was, that the Chazon Ish is referring to him. And I, for the first time, I let the, publicize this in the letter, right? A footnote to a letter from the Chaim Ozer to Rav Amiel. You can find this in the collected writings of Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, Volume 1, page 274. Shlomo Pick, Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Pick of the Bar-Ilan Kollel, who knows the family, saw the actual letter. And the name that's whited out is not Rabbi Soloveitchik. I can't tell you how many times it's been repeated this way, because the Rav said so, and it made sense, because there's only three people running, and if it's not referred to Rav Amiel, it has to be the Rav. But no, it's actually Rav Kahaneman. Rav Kahaneman must have, some people must have thought he'd make a good candidate, and they suggested it to Rav Chaim Ozer, but he never actually was an official candidate, and this is just a name that Rav Chaim Ozer was told about, so he thought he should be the chief rabbi. And one more thing about Rav Kahaneman. I don't know if any of you know this book by Rabbi Riskin. It's called Listening to God. It's a memoir. And I have to thank Rabbi Gibber of the Boca Jewish Center, because the Shabbat Shuba Drasha 2 days ago, he actually cited this passage, which I had read, but I totally forgot about. In Rabbi Riskin's memoir, he speaks about, age 97 and on, how he became close to Rav Kahaneman. Rav Kahaneman would come every year, you know, to raise money, more than 1 year, but he came every year for a number of years. He spent Shabbos at Rabbi Riskin's house and in his shul. Now, at this time, Rabbi Riskin was teaching at JSS, which was, I don't know what they call it today, that was YU's Kiruv program. And he says that the Ponavezha Rav, Rav Kahaneman, would meet these students at the Shabbos table. Then he became ill. He was in Mount Sinai Hospital. He needed a blood transfusion. And he asked Rabbi Riskin. He said that he only wanted to take blood from Shomrei Shabbos, but he wanted Balei Tshuva, because the Gemara says that where Balei Tshuva stand, that no one else can stand. So Rabbi Riskin arranged that Balei Tshuva from JSS provided the blood for Rav Kahaneman. So amazing story. Let's pick up now with back in Katz's book. He's sort of summarizing everything at the end of it. On page 277, he mentions 277, 278, he mentions that even in Radin, the home of the Chafetz Chaim, who was sympathetic to Musser, not saying he's a Mussernik like the Alter Sabaka, but very sympathetic, but the students didn't want it. And when they tried to institute it there, again, you had a revolt. He appointed Rav Yerucham Levavitz, later to be famous as the Mir Rosh Mashkiach. And it created so much controversy that Rav Yerucham had to leave, because too many of the students opposed it. And then he goes on, speaking about things we already spoke about. Volozhin, for instance. Volozhin, Rav Avraham Shapiro, when they reinstituted the Volozhin Yeshiva, he tried to institute Musar, and again, it wouldn't work. The students opposed it, and they had to stop. You know, the Mashgiachim who are appointed as Musar people, they have to leave. But it's only his son, Rav Avraham Shapiro's son, who in later years would institute Musar. Then, look, as we've seen, despite the opposition, we summarize that Musar emerges victorious. It makes it even into the anti-Musar yeshivos, and most of the opponents of Musar would change their mind. On page 283, Katz sums it up as follows. Pretty much everyone came to the realization that today's day and age, you cannot simply rely on the fact that you're going to teach them Talmud and the Mefarshim alone. That's not enough. Rather, just like in the Hasidic yeshivas, they don't only learn Talmud, they learn Hasidus, and some people spend a lot of time in that. The Lithuanian yeshivas also recognize that we need to add something in addition to Talmud, and this was Musar. He says there are yeshivas that establish other types of areas of Jewish thought, which were established by Gedol Yisrael. But the Tzana Shava, the thing that includes all of them, is that everyone acknowledged that in today's day and age, you need to be guided in matters of thought and hashkafa and machshava to fear of God. It's not enough just to study Talmud. You can't just give someone a Gemara and have him sit in the Beis Medrash for 13, 14 hours a day and think he's going to be a pious person. He'll be a Lamdan, but in today's day and age, you need more. And that leads us to page chapter 17, Sikum HaPumus, where Katz sums up the major issues. So we've seen all this, but he gives us a good summary. So let's look at the summary. And then in the midst of the summary, I don't know why he does it, he moves into the Chazon Ish. So we're going to follow his path through the summary and then deal with the Chazon Ish maybe. And then, but how does he summarize it? Well, he, he begins, first of all, speaking about Maskilim. We don't need to talk about Maskilim because we skipped them. He says, and just as a good review, what were the major issues that the opponents of Musar pointed to? First of all, that the study of Musar in an organized fashion is going to distract from intensive Gemara study, both in terms of the time and also just, you know, if you, you know, your mind is off Gemara, that's no good. This is superfluous because simply learning Gemara will malo merome masa adam and will raise up a person and bring him to perfection. That's the, we saw that and we saw the problems with this argument. That's the first point he mentions. Then he mentions the idea that Musar, of course, is supposed to bring you a form of, I guess, a spiritual excitement. He says that the rabbis who opposed it, again, you don't need this. This is really repeating what he just said, just learning Gemara. And he mentions that there was actually a dispute about this between Rav Simcha Zissel, the Yisrael Salanter's great student of Kelm, and Rav Meir Simcha of Davitz. Rav Meir Simcha was an opponent of Musar. He didn't sign the document we saw, the Mandas, but he was not an opponent. He was not a supporter of Musar. In fact, he was an opponent of it. Rav Meir Simcha brought the famous proof that the Gemara says, I created the Yetzer Hara and I created the Torah. That, you know, the Yetzer Hara will deal with the Torah. And what did Rav Simcha Zissel reply to him? That not all sicknesses are the same. And in today's day and age, we can't rely on one method for everyone. Today's day and age, we see that Talmud study alone is not going to keep people on the straight and narrow. And furthermore, Katz points out that the whole proof of Rav Meir Simcha itself is flawed. Because yes, it says I created the Yetzer Hara and I created the Torah. But what does Torah mean? It doesn't say Gemara. It says Torah. And certainly, as Katz points out, Sifrei Yira and Musar are included in the word of Torah. Is anyone going to say if you're sitting around learning the Ramchal, you're not learning Torah? It doesn't say Gemara alone. It says Torah. That's the second point. The third point he mentions, and this was the opinion of many rabbis, that yes, Musar is important, but you can learn Musar from Nevi'im, from Ketuvim. You can learn Sefer Iyov. You can look at Tehillim. You can do the, what Mishle. You don't need new books, and you don't need to have a Musar Shmooze, where a figure known as a Mashkiach, who in the yeshiva is sort of like a counterpart at odds with, and really in competition for the allegiance of the students, he's presenting his own ideas. You can teach your own ideas. We have it all. We have it in the Agadatas as well. Katz says, as you can imagine, that this view is not correct at all. First of all, he says that the study of Musar, not only does it not reduce attention to Nevi'im, Kesuvim, and Agados, on the contrary, it's based on it. And he says others claim, this is number fourth, that fine, if you want Balabatim, yeah, they let them learn a little Musar, but B'nai Torah, they don't need to establish time for special Musar Sedarim. And nevertheless, and not only that, they say, as we saw, that Rav Yisrael Salanter didn't want this, but we know that's not true. Rav Yisrael Salanter established for his greatest students, Talmudic scholars, the study of Musar. And then we know that there were people who opposed it because the tzura, as you can call it, that you know, they called it a cult, a sect, that these organized groups that would get together, the Musar houses, etc., etc., and the pa'ulos, it's called, the actions they did, you know, be it hispodedus by themselves, or bate Musar, where they would talk, they would go through each other's negative and positive characteristics, Bacharusa. They'd review the Musar Shmooze. They'd speak about, you know, have a Chavrusa on Tikkun HaMidos, you know, how to improve our characteristics. Who ever heard of a Chavrusa on Tikkun HaMidos, you know? I mean, but so people, they opposed it and said that, you know, this is something new that our forefathers didn't know about. Now, Katz acknowledges, you know, Katz says that many of these rabbis were exaggerating in the way they described what was going on in the Musar world. And let's not forget, he says, that Rav Yisrael Salanter was the one that created these ideas and created these things. So, for instance, one of the things they, if you know how Musar was studied, it wasn't read. There was a whole tune. You would sing it. You'd scream out. You'd be like, you know. And the rabbi's looking at this like, what's going on here? This is like they're performing this. What is this? But this goes back to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Salanter said that the Kriya Regila, a simple reading of Sifrei Musar, doesn't create any, it doesn't leave any imprint. So therefore, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter himself decreed that you should study different mamarim and works, Palmin Rabos Vakole Kolos, Bis Rakshus Rabov Saras HaNefesh, that you should get yourself excited in a spiritual way, enraptured, in when you study Musar. Saras HaNefesh, spiritual excitement. I guess that's the way, I don't know how better to translate that. Not calm, the exact opposite of calm, because that will, make an imprint on you. Just like when you learn Gemara, you don't sit there quietly. Some people sit quietly, but if you've been to base medrash, you know, even people by themselves, they learn it out loud because you hear it. It means it's more important if you read it out loud. It sticks with you. That's what most people think. So too, when you're learning Musar, you're not supposed to do it quietly. And for that very reason, Rishon Salanter founded the Bate Musar. Rishon Salanter founded Musar houses. He founded one Musar house, and he said there should be in front of more than one. Why? Because you're not supposed to learn Musar as people used to. By yourself, you pick up a Ramchal, you pick up another the work of classic Musar, the Chovos Levavos, as we have many Musar Svarim. That's not how you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to do it together in a group. in the house. Now you could learn it in a chavrusa, you could learn it by yourself, but being together with other people, one, and being in a house that's dedicated to Mussar, Rabbi Shaul Salanter thought that this is like going to a hospital for people with, I guess, chole nefesh, emotional problems, spiritual problems, mental problems, that when you walk in and you see it's an actual place, you know, where people are devoting themselves to improving that, it'll help you. Katz on page 298 and 299 mentions that Rav Shmuel Salant, the Rav of Jerusalem, asked Rabbi Shaul Salanter when they were together, like, why are you creating these Mussar houses? No one ever heard of such a thing before. And he says that Rabbi Shaul Salanter said, he gave an example where someone came with a sickness to the doctor, and the doctor gave him a diet, a special diet that he should follow, very strict. And the sick person was upset, and he said that he says, everyone I know, they don't follow this diet, and they're all healthy. And the doctor explains that you can't compare a sick person to a healthy person. The healthy person can do what he wants, but a sick person, and today we're all in the category of sick people. He says, in the earlier generations, they were more healthy. Today we're not. Now, and this isn't just an example of like the rabbis always say, you know, they always look back to the previous generations, the nostalgia that, you know, things today are so bad, things today in the past were so good. The fact is, this is true. 300 years before Rosh Hashanah, 200 years, you didn't have Haskalah. You didn't have irreligiosity. You had people who were not as pious as they should have been, but everyone recognized the Torah as the way you should live. Not everyone lived up to it. And you had Leitzim, you know, and people who were mockers and things like that. But the idea that you're just going to throw it all away, no, even these people knew come Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, they have to go to Shul and repent. So you had a society, a religious society. Now religious society is completely being challenged by Haskalah, by revolutionary movements, by all sorts of things, and all sorts of ideologies that didn't exist. So Rishon Salanter said, today we're in a different era, Doreinu Chola, since our generation is sick, we need to find new approaches. It's like if someone were to say today, I've mentioned in the past that in the yeshivas in New York, what they do is they have during the modern Orthodox ones, they have during Super Bowl Sunday in halftime, you know, they have you call in, or they have a Zoom thing, they do learning for a half hour. I never heard of that before a few years ago. When I was young, they certainly didn't do that. The rabbi simply said, don't watch the Super Bowl. And obviously, 100 years ago, this wasn't an issue. But so today, you'd say, well, today we're sick. We have a sickness. The people are addicted to the Super Bowl, so they're all watching it. So we need a new approach. And therefore, we have Torah during the halftime show. And it also helps because the halftime show is usually not the most modest thing. So in other words, that's all Rabbi Shaul Salanter is saying, something that everyone today, I think, recognizes, that traditional Judaism has to respond in a way that's relevant to the contemporary circumstance. And the fact that in previous generations they didn't do it, just like now, when we do on Tisha B'Av with the kinos. You're going to say, well, previous generations didn't, you know, abridge it and just pick a few and explain them. Well, previous generations could sit for hours and hours at kinos. The Lincoln Douglas debates went on for hours and hours. We don't have the koach to do that anymore, so they adapt. Now, in terms of the Mussar houses, I want to read you something. Here's from Tnuas HaMussar. That's the first volume that Katz wrote in the Mussar movement. Volume one, pages, where is this? Page 264 and 265. He talks about how he established the base Mussar, which is separate, just a place that would be open all day and all night, and Mussar books would be there. So whenever you wanted to go in the middle of the day, 2 o'clock, you can go there and study Mussar. You know, when you're done working, you can go there. But he says, yes, Hasidim established shtiblach, but a base Mussar is not a shtibl. Why? In the base Mussar, you also davened there. That was important. They were a place also to gather. You can gather with your friends and have a coffee and sichas chul and maisios, they would tell all that singing. But no, the Beit Musar is only for Musar, for machshava, to ponder your place in the world. They did not even have, they didn't allow it. No minyanim were in the Beit Musar. Because you don't want to compete with the shuls. This isn't a sectarian movement. When it's time for davening, you go to the shuls. Not only that, you don't learn Gemara in the Beis Musar. You're not koveh eating with Torah there. Rather, you go to the Beis Medrash for that. The Beis Musar is just to focus on Musar. And then he explains again, how you come there and you're supposed, it's all about tikkun nefesh, improving yourself. How it's also it's a defense against the outside world. Everyone sees that and recognizes that we have problems. Just like there's hospitals for sick the sick body, we need hospitals for the soul. And this is what the Beis Musar is. And he says that the Beis Musar would be very popular Shabbos, Bein HaShemashos. That's when they would gather there. And then they would daven, then they after, until it got dark, they would have daven mincha earlier. They come there, and when they stay there till it gets dark, an hour or so, and then they go daven in the shul. And it gave them, strengthened them, effervescence, brought, I don't know the word I'm looking for, but rejuvenated them, spiritually rejuvenated them. But this, and I'll end with this, because this is important, and it's in Yonah Dioma. Page 270. He says, though, that you need to understand that for Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Musar is not a replacement for Gemara and Poskim. With all the greatness of Musar, he warned that it cannot disturb the study of Gemara and the traditional Talmudic learning, except for one time a year. You know what one time a year is? Right now. Except for in the Aseret Yemei Teshuva. Because then he says, in the Aseret Yemei Teshuva, if you focus on Musar and your Talmudic study is disturbed, Ein Lachush. Don't worry about it, because now we have Avoda Rabba L'asos Tshuva. Sheyocho Lamar. During this week, it's okay to push aside Gemara learning and focus on Musar, because we're coming to Yom Kippur, and we need to be at a level to do Tshuva properly. But this is an exception. Normally, as he says, Musar is snif Luma Gemara. It's not the main thing. It's a side thing. It's vital. It's necessary. You can't even learn Gemara properly, according to him, if you don't have this Musar background. But we have to know what we say in Hebrew, the Ikar and the Tafel. Traditional Torah study is the Ikar, and we know that Rav Yisrael Salanter was himself a great Torah scholar in a traditional fashion. And Musar, although it's necessary, is secondary. And then he quotes the famous story at the bottom here, where someone came to Rav Yisrael Salanter and says he only has 1 hour a week. What should he learn, Gemara or Musar? And Rav Yisrael said to him, actually, for that hour, learn Musar, because then you'll see that you'll have enough time also to learn Gemara. So I don't know if it's a true story. It's a cute story. But the upshot of it is that really Gemara is the most important. If you learn the Musar, then you'll see you have enough time for Gemara and you'll be able to fit in your Musar. So we will pick up the next class, continuing on a little bit of his Sikkum, and then and then move into the Chazon Ish, because I'm going to give you his presentation of the Chazon Ish, but I have a lot of material that's not in Katz and really complicates the picture with some fascinating things and a machlokas between the Chazon Ish and the Musar teachers. And of course, we'll have to deal with, I'm sure, Chaim Grada, because Chaim Grada, his portrayal, and he sets the Chazon Ish as like the rational person who's a Torah scholar, who's, sees things clearly, and that's the one you're supposed to admire, versus the Mivartiker, who's is extremism. The Chazon Ish represents their Torah in a normal, to use that term, path versus the extremist of the Nevardic. So we will get to that next class. And Ellen says, falsify national history, consider People's Republic of China. Yeah, well, you know, in the first generation, they didn't believe it, but you go to China now, probably, and the masses, or you go to North Korea, the masses will believe this stuff. I have no doubt of that. Ruth says, how did these rabbis think the oligarchs got all this land to start with? Taking stolen good from robbers is not stealing. I think that's Robitzel's point. But it gets to be, it gets a little controversial because I would say, Ruth, I mean, where do you draw the line? Some of this prop, some of the stuff that they could have bought, they could have become businessmen and, you know, bought it themselves. I don't know where. And then once you start removing land, it's not just the super robber barons. Then you start moving down to lesser people, and there is the notion of private property, which you're right. Ravitzela said what he said, but the other rabbis thought that it's reported elsewhere that Ravitzela said, Yaakov Mark claims that Ravitzela says they could take the property, but they have to reimburse the wealthy people. The problem is that that's not in Graubart. Graubart doesn't say that. Graubart just says that, you know, this is what the people want, and they think it's fair, and therefore the view of the people, the das of the people, you know, amcha, the pious Jewish masses, is even above that of the rabbis who are so concerned about these halachic particulars, you know, is it geneva if you take it, etc. Moshe says he learnt in Slabodka by Rabitzela. No, I think Admor, of course, does not mean a Hasidic Rebbe, but sometimes when you look to a Rebbe and the Rebbe is so close to you and you idolize him so much, you find even non-Hasidim who use the expression Admor about a non-Hasidic Rebbe. You'll find it occasionally. You even find it now in the Sephardic world. They'll say about Rav Ovadia Yosef. And you say, Moshe, sounds like the same sentiment in the story that Rav Fleckel says about his Rebbe Noda Yehuda, about someone wanting to use his Arba Minim. And I believe he also said a story about someone asking Noda Yehuda, we should have in mind by the shofar, and he answered to fill the mitzvah. Okay. Well, the Noda Yehuda's concern with about was with the Hasidim. The Hasidim are trying to say, you have all these other ideas about the heavenly spheres, or and he said no. He has a tshuva on it when he deals with the tshuva. It's tshuva 93 in Or HaChaim in the Noda Bihuda, where he deals with L'shem Yichud. And you know, because the Hasidim, just to do the mitzvah is not enough, so you have to think about all the spheres, the Kabbalistic spheres, and what you have in mind. And that's where the Noda Bihuda explains his position that Kavana to do the mitzvah is not kavana on Lashem Yichud or anything. It's kavana to do the mitzvah. That's the kavana to have. Moshe again says that Rav Meskin has a lot of interesting material, many interesting tshuvos. There's one about an aguda from the Titanic. Yes, there is indeed one about a aguda from the Titanic and comments of Chushi Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi. Here's an example of one, a rabbi, one of these rabbis who ended up in you know, Burlington, Vermont. He was a gaon in learning, and his svarim are really interesting. He had correspondence also with Rechiel Yaakov Weinberg. He's a, you know, a rav and lita, and he comes to America and he gets a position. But the big, you had big rabbanim in all these places around America. It's amazing when you think about it. Many of them ended up in New York, but a lot of them just spent their entire life in these small little places. We've spoken about the great Ratzir Skrzynski, whose whole life is in Omaha, but you had Rabbanim all over. And Moshe, you say the separation of the Beis Musar is reminiscent of what seems from the Gemara as a separation of the Beis Knesset from the Beis Midrash, something which doesn't seem to exist today. The only way it exists today, I would say, is in the big shuls. I mean, the small shuls, the Beis Midrash is the shul, is the shul. And by the way, because it's a Beis Midrash also, therefore they can eat, they can sleep, they can do all that. But in all the big, think of the big shuls, the big modern Orthodox shuls. Do you have, yeah, big Haredi shuls also? Well, I shouldn't, I actually know the big Haredi shuls I'm thinking of, a lot of them they actually learn in the, but not all of them, but many of them do learn in the actual room where they daven. But you take a big modern Orthodox shul, they're not learning in the sanctuary. They're learning in a separate library or Beis Medrash, but the sanctuary is for davening. And finally, you say, Moshe, yes, Musar leads to more Gemara, and Musar Talmud Torah leads to doing that, which is the ultimate purpose, as the Gemara Kedushin says. And I would agree with you that a Musar emerges victorious, and everyone understands what you're saying. Does this mean that today is Musar like they used to have? We know that in many yeshivas, they don't take it so seriously, and you can't, I don't know if you can really speak about Musar the way it was when the altar of Slabodka was doing it. So it's, there's been a degeneration, but at least I think that even the people who don't participate recognize that it's valuable, and maybe they see themselves as the Yechidei Sgura. And so although we don't exactly have Musar like we had it in Slabodka years ago, it's much closer to what it was than the opposite. And every yeshiva recognizes there should be a Musar Shmuz, and the Musar Shmuz should inspire you. And if it doesn't, well, maybe you need a new Mashgiach. Okay, I want to, Rabbi Kelman was not able to be here tonight. There's something important going on October 7th, obviously. And if you don't want to give yourself agita and put yourself in depression, keep away from the news, because otherwise you'd see what's going on in New York and other places today, where the other side is actually out celebrating October 7th for what was achieved. And Jews, unfortunately, people, at least halachically Jewish, but maybe Rav Soloveitchik would say that they're not in part of our community, because they're certainly acting like Mishumadim, have taken a role in all this. So, but in Toronto tonight, there's a big Federation event, as there's been around the country, commemorating the horror of October 7th, which unfortunately hasn't ended. So he could not be here tonight. So I will say good night to all of you. Just wish you, you know, Gemar Chasima Tova for Yom Kippur. And we will meet next Monday, God willing. I think maybe we have two, three more classes of this. And again, I really am enjoying this. And I want to thank, I don't know if you're with us tonight, Rabbi Yellen, Yaakov, for suggesting it to me to do this class, classes last year. And it's been really great so far. So good night, everyone.
Rabbi Shapiro, are you going to discuss Rabbi Dessler at all before you end your
Midwest? No, I'm not going to discuss Rabbi Dessler, because the classes are not on the Musar movement per se, although the email that went out says Musar and Enlightenment happened, supposed to say Musar dispute. Maybe we'll do new classes that speak about the Musar movement. Rabbi Dessler is like the third generation. This was focused on the Musar dispute. And of course, we have to deal with Musar, but by the time you get to Rabbi Dessler, there's no more dispute. But maybe we'll continue on with the Musar movement itself, the different approaches to Musar. We're going to talk a little bit more about Navardic, and we'll deal with the Chazon Ish. So, but I'm not going to speak about Rabbi Dessler per se. Okay, good night, all.